Just going to move that because I kept treading on this wire last night. There we go, that's better. Good. So we're going to look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1 this morning. There is one slide here which may perform or may not perform when we get to it. So when we get to that point, when I'm fiddling around here, it kind of may or may not work, but just so you know, that's where we're going. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, 1 to 11. Let me read it first. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I said last night about never having had a proper job. I did have done various kind of fill-in jobs, and as a holiday job, one summer, a whole load of us students from the same uni worked together in a Mr. Kipling's cake factory. My job was to operate a kind of hand forklift truck thing, and I had to take stacks of flattened cardboard boxes to the end of the conveyor belts for the cakes to be put in. The girls in our group, they all had the job of working on the cherry Bakewell tart line. They were each given a large tray of cherries, and the conveyor belt went in front of them with tarts without cherries, and their job was to put a cherry on each tart. Our shifts lasted 13 hours a day. And believe me, it doesn't take long doing that with a cherry before you're thinking, this is no way to live. What is the point of this? The answer, by the way, is money. That's the point of it. And there are moments, aren't there, like a wonderful summer holiday where maybe you get a new perspective on it, or maybe a church weekend away is similar. And then you look back at the humdrum, the mundane, the ordinariness of life, and you see it for what it is. Maybe you're lying in the shade of a Tuscan olive tree and you're next to a deliciously cool private pool. The air is cool, clear, the food is good, you're swimming every day, you're reading lazily. You feel re-educated, you feel refreshed by the poetry of great writers. And in the cool of the evening, as you're sipping on a glass of chilled Prosecco, the thought occurs with blinding clarity. Why is it I spend a couple of weeks each year doing this and 50 weeks a year inhaling carbon monoxide, looking at wet tarmac and eating curled up sandwiches? When I get home from my holiday, you think, I'm going to set about making some changes. I could easily fit in an hour's reading every day. Just think of the books I could read. I'll join a gym. We'll go on family nature walks. And for 3 days when you get back, everybody says, wow, you look great. But then quickly that you turn a sort of pallid, orangey, grey colour. People start saying, oh, you look terrible. I thought you went away. And the lurid Bermuda shorts get packed away. The bookshelves gather next the dust until next summer when you go through the whole process again. What is the point? What is our life? And what we're going to do this weekend is turn now to the scrapbook, as I was suggesting last night, that the preacher, the teacher, or the collector has put together, all the things that he's gathered together. Let's have a look at this first chapter. And my heading for the first bit, for verses 3 to 7, is this, that we come and go. The collector asks us, what is our daily life? Look at verse 3. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? You know, we busy ourselves at some job at Rolls-Royce where we're underpaid, we're undervalued, we We busy ourselves at all the things we fill our lives with, the labor and the toil. What gain is there? What do I have to show for it? What is the point of it all? Verse 4, generations come, generations go. We come, we go. That's the pattern. It's just like the sun in verse 5. The sun rises and the sun sets. And then it hurries back to where it rises. It goes round and round its circuit like a runner that can't stop, round and round and round. It's just the same with the wind, verse 6. It blows to the south, it turns to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. Where's the wind going in such a hurry? You know, the weather forecasters may describe what it does. They may even talk about the patterns that cause it. They may be able to say, we've seen this tiny little grey blob, and the computer predictions say it's going to be the worst weather you've ever experienced in your life on Sunday night. But they can't tell us why the wind just keeps going round and round and round. And where does it go when it passes us? I mean, it just goes on, does it? And blows around the next bit and goes all around again. It's just the same, verse 7, as water. All streams run into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams come from, there they return again. It's just another endless pattern of coming and going, round and round and round. So streams go into rivers, rivers flow down into the sea. The sea does whatever it does that makes it become clouds. The clouds do whatever the clouds do that makes them become rain. The rain falls into streams, into rivers, and so on. And it's just the way the world is, and we're part of it. So verse 4, generations come and generations go. What is the point of all the labor and toil that fills our life? Because we're just part of something that's going on and on and on, round and round and round. So we travel to and from the office. We spend our days sitting in front of a screen, and by the end of the week, we're too exhausted to do anything other than go home and sit in front of another screen. And next week, just like the sun, just like the wind, just like the water, it'll all happen again. That is our life. This is how somebody describes it. We take to routines as if we were premature residents in an old people's home. We up and dress and sit staring into space in the lounge until bedtime with no real sense of purpose at all. That is your life. Those of you who are students will be sitting here thinking, not me, I'm never going to be a commuter. But let me just say that is what every commuter thought when they were students too. And look what happened to them. Or look on to chapter 2, verse 21, and see the way the writer puts it there. 2:21. Because sometimes a person who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by somebody who didn't toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What does a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, his work is a vexation, and even in the night his heart doesn't rest. This also is a vanity. So why work to make your small business a multinational? Why cram to get a 2-1 rather than a 2-2? Why overstretch yourself, mortgaged up to the eyeballs, so you've got a spare bedroom that is empty most of the time? The debit column is full of items like stress and ulcers and sleepless night, according to verse 23. It's all just anxiety and pain and grief. And all of that stuff adds up to far more than is in the credit column. And what is worse, verse 21, it all get left to somebody else anyway. All that stuff you spent your life struggling for. You don't get to enjoy it, you just give it on to the next person. What is the point of it? So it is all like that conveyor belt at a Mr. Kipling's cake factory. It's a very poignant description of what life is like. What my life, what your life is like. You are just a cherry Bakewell tart on a conveyor belt. And the belt just churns on. We come out of the baby-making bit of the machine. We travel along the belt with a bit of this added and a bit of that added until we just drop off the other end. And we find ourselves not in a cardboard box with Mr. Kipling's written on it, but in a wooden coffin with our name written on it. An endless repeating cycle. What's the point? What is our life? Here is the bit that may or may not work. Here is the bit that will not work. Okay, moving on. So, second thing then, let's come back and look at verses 8 to 10. We do nothing new. Verse 8. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it said, see, this is new? It's already been in the ages before us. If only, we think, if only there was some new spice in my life. If only I had more money. If only I had some money. If only I could get onto the fast-track career path. If only I had a more attractive wife, stroke, girlfriend, stroke, real hunk, stroke, delete, whichever doesn't apply. If only I lived in a better house or a better area. If only I lived in a flat rather than in this. If only I'd gone to a different school. If only, because then things would be better. And advertisers come along and they infect us with a virus to encourage that kind of discontent. So I'm never beautiful enough. I never earn enough. My clothes aren't fashionable enough. My car isn't smart enough. My mobile is last year's model. My food isn't from Sainsbury's Taste the Difference range. My relationships aren't romantic enough. Just watch the telly and it encourages that discontent. Or as the second half of verse 8 says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. Our desire for things, for new things, it's psychotic almost. You know, why do I buy things that I do not want to impress people that I do not like? Why do we do that? The other day, I caught myself on eBay looking at solid oak pew ends. And I found myself thinking, that's nice. I don't have one of those. Presumably, I click things because I think this new thing, that's the thing that's going to change everything. But actually, as verse 9 puts it, what has been will be again. What has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. The 21st of July, 1969, was my 12th birthday. 56, by the way, before you do the sum. And it was the day when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. Small step for man, a great giant leap for mankind. And at that time, there was a kind of international optimism around that this was the start of a brand new age. This giant leap forward was going to bring in an entirely new era in humankindness. It was going to be tremendous. And then just 10 years later, one cynical commentator wrote this. You can walk on the moon if you like, but there's nothing to do there except look at the Earth. And when you've seen one Earth, you've seen them all. The playwright Samuel Beckett begins his novel Murphy with this line. The sun shone, having no alternative on the nothing new. Verse 10, is there anything of which it said, see, this is new? No, our lives are full of the nothing new. Nothing changes. Sure, there are new inventions. There's new technology. There are advances in medicine. There's always a new mobile phone. There's much more. But in the end, what is different? The more things change, the more they stay the same. And anything we dream about as that'd be the icing on the cake, well, it's from the same machine that dollops icing on your cake and the icing onto everybody else's cake. There's nothing new. And all the cherries are the same as well. You've seen one cherry, you've seen them all. And the collector who wrote this knew what he was talking about. So if you turn on to chapter 2, you'll see that as chapter 2 describes all the research that he has done. He tries out laughter and alcohol, the comedy club and the pub. He tries grand designs. He tries homes and gardens. He tries the footsie. He tries bankers' bonuses. He tries wine, women and song, the whole lot, everything. He did do the research, but he concluded at the end, as we've seen in chapter 1, there's nothing new. And the third thing he says about our life in verse 11, is that we're not remembered. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I heard on the radio that the world population is growing by 2.8 people per second. That is not just 2.8 people are born per second, but as each second goes past, the total number of human beings alive on the earth increases by 2.8 every single second. So that is an increase of 88 million people in the year, on the earth every year. I have a little counter on my desktop on my computer that clicks the world population figure at that rate. We're approaching the seven, we're just up past the 7.1 billion at the moment. How many of the people alive on the earth do you know? And how many of them will you remember? Okay, we can't remember everybody, don't be stupid, but what about those we love? You know, we go to a funeral, and the person that we love, their life is remembered as a 7 or 8 minute eulogy. And I want to ask, what happened to the other 70 or 80 years? Who's remembering that? Or put it this way, how many of us know the names of our own ancestors from 150 years ago? Actually, I do know names of people in my family from 150 years ago, so let's go a bit longer. 200 years ago. How many of us know the names of our family from 200 years ago? I don't even remember the names of my own family. I've got a lovely Victorian photo album at home that's got photos from our family's past. It's got groups of Victorian workmen. They're wearing waistcoats and collarless shirts and bowler hats. There are stern, kind of ample-bosomed matriarchs, and the children and grandchildren gathered around. Some are formal family groups, all ages gathered there, the occasional dog, and there they are, all forced to maintain this kind of grumpy face for an impossibly long moment. Those people are my family. I've no idea who they are. As my parents' generation die out, my brother, my sister, me, we can't give names to those people anymore. I know that there was somebody called Uncle Frank who lived sometime in the early 1900s, but I have no idea which one of the men on the photos is Uncle Frank. So who's going to remember me in 200 years' time? Nobody. Nigel Stiles, my name, it's just going to be a collection of 11 letters from the alphabet, some random collection of 11 letters filed in some faceless registrar's office under births and deaths. That's my life. Generations come and generations go, verse 4. And verse 11, nobody remembers them. We're forgotten. Years later, there will be some children, I guess, kicking leaves in some churchyard somewhere. They'll subtract my birth date from my death date, and they'll laugh at old-fashioned names like Nigel. That's the best I can hope for. What is the point? Well, according to chapter 1, verse 13, we're told there that it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man. Or, another translation, it is a heavy burden that God has put on us. In other words, he's made us, made it to be like this. So our experience of how life is, that is the heavy burden, the business, the unhappy business that God has given to us. And right at the very end of the book of Ecclesiastes, the collector says that God has done it to goad us. A goad is a long stick with a sharp point on the end that you stick into the bottoms of animals to make them go somewhere. So in other words, we're meant to be prodded by Ecclesiastes. We're meant to feel a kind of sharp point stuck in our bum this weekend. We're meant to be asking questions like this. What is the point? Now, of course, that can be a cry of despair, can't it? Oh, what's the point? But it can be a genuine question, can't it? What is the point, actually? Some of us respond by making ourselves very, very busy. We refuse to take this lying down. We're going to live life to the full, so we try and make it even fuller. So we cram in more and more, and we exchange life for overcommitment and pressure and hectic schedules. We're full of activity, full of achievements, full of acquaintances, or full of our kids' activity and achievement and acquaintances. And if we're Christian, we may make ourselves busier with Christian commitments. After all, Jesus came to give us life in its fullness, so let's make it even fuller. The busier I am, the more significant my Christian life must be. Or maybe instead of being busy, maybe it's escapism for you. Maybe that's the way that you cope with the humdrum normality of life. Maybe it's the escape of the internet. Maybe it's the escape of the gym, dreaming of sculpting the perfect body. Maybe it's adrenaline, the ultimate adrenaline adventure of zorbing down Everest or whatever it is for you. Or maybe it's just living for the weekend, planning the next holiday. Maybe that's the escapism. Or maybe it's just the escape of sleep. The land of Nod is where we re-enter Eden, when of course we know the land of Nod is actually east of Eden and not there at all. And then you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night and you have a panic moment. And you think, I can't cope if I don't get enough downtime. We try to take control, don't we? Because we want to tame life somehow, anyhow. Surely we can find peace and satisfaction and pleasure. Surely we can find happiness somewhere. Surely somewhere we can do things, find something that makes us feel, yet our life is significant. If only I could just stop this wretched conveyor belt that I'm on. Now, about this point, you may be wondering what's going on. Why is this strange book in the Bible? Who is this collector? What's he playing at with this collection, with this scrapbook? You know, he's trawled the high street and he's come back with his trolley full of all kinds of stuff and he's put the whole lot on display, life on display. And he's saying, take a look at this, what do you make of it? But who is this guy saying that to us? Because across the whole lot, he's already told us what he makes of it all. Look down to verse 2. He's got out his can of spray paint and he's scrawled graffiti right the way across it, saying, this is what I make of it. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Or perhaps the more familiar translation, all is meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That's what he thinks of it all. And over 30 times in the book, he tells us what he includes when he says everything is meaningless. And it turns out he really does mean everything, the whole lot. So pleasure is meaningless, he says. Everything my hands do is meaningless. Work, achievement, wealth, all of those things are meaningless. Who is to be the next king? It's meaningless whether it's Charles or William or George. Wanting more, laughter and fun. The fact that things in life are unfair, he thinks that's meaningless too. The future is meaningless. Being young, being old, dying, the whole caboodle, the whole lot. Life itself, it's all meaningless. At times, he is very bleak. Just turn on to chapter 9. Let me give you an example of how bleak he gets. Chapter 9, verse 2. It's the same for everybody, he says, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he who swears, as is he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also the hearts of children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. That's the same event that happens to all that he's talking about, that everybody dies. But, verse 4, he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. Aha, you think. A shaft of light in the bleakness of Ecclesiastes. It is better, he says, to be alive than to be a dead. Why is it better to be alive? Verse 5, for the living know they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they've no reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Why is it better to be alive? Well, at least you know you're going to die, whereas once you're dead, you don't know anything. So there's a shaft of light to spur you on your way this weekend. As you go back encouraged from the weekend, you can say, well, at least I know I'm going to die, rather than being dead, so I don't even know that. At which point, you might want to shout out, never mind stopping the conveyor belt. Just stop the collector, will you? Stop that man. Stop Nigel going on and on like this. I didn't come away on this weekend to be told this. I came away to be encouraged. I already know how meaningless my life is. I don't mean my nose rubbed in it. So we do need to be asking, you know, what is this book doing in the Bible? What exactly does the preacher, the teacher, the collector mean? Is it really true that everything is meaningless? Surely that isn't what Christians believe, is it? So, one theory is the following. Just go one more. One theory to explain this book of Ecclesiastes is this, and this is a very popular view. And basically, the view goes like this, that Ecclesiastes is describing life with God taken out of the picture. Life under the sun, which is a phrase that keeps coming through the book, life under the sun is human life without God, this theory says. And so Ecclesiastes is telling us that life without God is meaningless. So the writer tries to find meaning. He tries this, he tries that. But ultimately, everything he tries is unfulfilling. Of course it's unfulfilling without God. Until, of course, at the end of his search, in chapter 12, he finally turns to God. Chapter 12, verse 1, remember your creator, he says. And a bit like a magician producing a white rabbit out of a top hat, hey presto, everything is put right again. Life without God is meaningless, but life with God is full of meaning. Life with God is very different from life under the sun. So you consider as an alternative life above the sun. Isn't that perspective very different? So in other words, according to this view, that what the book is doing is basically telling the story, if you like, of somebody coming to faith. It's a kind of evangelistic testimony. My life was meaningless until I discovered God. I put him at the center of my life and everything changed. But the problem is that that's rather a simplistic view, because God isn't taken out of the picture in Ecclesiastes. He features all the way through. There's lots of God in the book. And again throughout the book, he's referred to as the creator, the one who gives us everything, the judge. The creator from whom everything comes, the judge who will assess everything that he's given to us. And it's true that God is very different from us. He's beyond our understanding. He's to be feared, but he's not absent. And actually, according to Ecclesiastes, even some of the things that he does are meaningless. So that theory doesn't seem to work. So here's another theory, that basically what we've got in Ecclesiastes is a godly man's description of what life is like. Even with God, even for the godly person, life is like this. So the collector is saying, come on everybody, have a look at what life is really like on earth. And isn't this the life that we all recognize, whether we're Christian or not? I don't know if you are a Christian or not. I've not met most of you. But I do know we share this experience. Life is like this. And all those things I've been describing, that is our life. Isn't it true that things aren't neat? They don't always work out. Things are unfair. Some things, well, we just don't know why they are like they are. They just turn out to be like that. We often don't understand why this or that happens. And we live our life, and there are all kinds of loose ends and unanswered questions. We try and make sense of it. We try and say, I don't really know why that happened yet. As if there's going to be some point when we will look back on some strange, bizarre experience, and suddenly we'll think, oh, now I understand it. But often we don't, do we? Those loose ends, those unanswered questions, the resolution for those things are only going to come at a future end-time judgment. And according to this view, what Ecclesiastes is doing is saying that there isn't going to be resolution in this life, but after it, beyond it. We long for a new heaven and a new earth. We long to be back in the garden that we're outside of. We long for the resolution of all the emptiness that there is in life. Yeah, I know there's a bit of fun and laughter as well. Ecclesiastes recognizes that. But we long for the resolution of the big picture, and we won't find that in this world, but in the next. We won't find that east of Eden, but only back in the Garden of Eden. In other words, according to this view, what the collector is showing us is that the life, universe, and everything has been affected by the consequences of humanity's rebellion against God. Everything is messed up by sin. It really is that bad. It's messed up everything. Nothing remains unaffected. And wherever we look in this world, whether we're a Christian or not, we share this experience. Because whether we're a Christian or not, we live outside the Garden of Eden. We all live in a fallen world. Becoming a Christian doesn't stop us living in a fallen world. Getting to heaven does, but living in this world, it's still fallen. Everything is east of Eden, and everything is always less than we'd like it to be, hope it to be, or even imagine that it would be. Now, I think that all of this makes sense of Ecclesiastes, because this is exactly what it's like. You see, if you take the three headings that I've just given us from chapter 1, Christian or not, isn't it true that we come and we go? Isn't it true that we do nothing new? And isn't it true that we're not remembered? The truth hurts. And that is the pain that we face living in this world. I mean, look down to verse 18. One paraphrase of verse 18 translates it as the last bit. The more you understand, the more you ache. He who increases in knowledge increases sorrow. The more you understand, the more you ache. And patterns of endless activity that we are very good at as Christians, or numbing escapism of whatever form that might take, all of those things are just an aspirin that doesn't really remove whatever it is that's actually causing the ache. And what the collector does, I think, is take us by the scruff of our neck and forces us to stare hard and long at our life, at this conveyor belt that is our life, the conveyor belt that we're travelling along. He won't let us hide our eyes. He won't let us say, no, I don't want to face that. I want to think about lovely things like joy and bunny rabbits and sunshine. He won't let us hide our eyes from the reality of life that it really is. He wants us to face up. This is what it is life like east of Eden. This is what it is like outside the garden. This is it. And this is as good as it's going to get in a fallen world. Which leaves us with the question with which we more or less began, what is the point of our lives then? And that, I think, would be a very good question to ask one another over coffee. What's the point of your life? Why don't you try that in the coffee queue as you stand next to somebody? What's the point of your life? Justify your existence. And what we're going to do is come back and look at chapter 3 later. Shall I pray as we finish for now? Father God, thank you that this book is in the Bible. It's a weird book, a strange book, very different from other books in the Bible. But how refreshing it is to face somebody speaking of the reality of our existence. If we're honest, if we really face up to what our life is, yes, there's maybe some joy and laughter on the way, but so much of the things that we've been thinking about this morning, if we're honest, that is what our life is like. And there is that sense all the time, what is the point of this? What is our life for? And thank you that Ecclesiastes faces us with that question and with the truth of our existence. As we grapple with these big questions this weekend, please would you help us to understand more of what it is like to live east of Eden, what it is like to live in a world where everything is affected by sin and its consequences, where nothing is as it should be and everything is messed up. And as we understand that more, please, Father God, grow in us a strong longing for the new heaven and the new earth, where everything will be put right again. So may this book do us loads of good this weekend. May it be a real tonic to us. And help us now as we talk about these things. And as we mull these things over today, as we think about the things we're doing, like wiping a baby's bottom or dishing out some food or going on a walk, as we think about those things, and as we reflect, what is the point of this? We pray, Heavenly Father, that you will be using our experience this weekend alongside this book of Ecclesiastes to grow us in our understanding of what it means to live in this world. For Jesus' sake, amen.